Tonight's talk is entitled Utterly Ordinary. After a number of years of practice, 8 years of pretty intensive practice, and several of those years as a monk in Thailand, I came back from Asia, and I went back to IMS for a brief period of time. And I felt that phase of my practice had shifted, that long-term retreating just was moving into a different phase, and I was longing to get more engaged in my life, and so I had an opportunity for a couple of hospice jobs. One was relatively close to the IMS Center, and the other one was in Houston, Texas, which is a long distance from it. And I took the one in Houston because I knew I had to get out of the ambiance, the field of meditation completely. I felt as if my years of practice were extraordinarily valuable. It wasn't that. It was that people were beginning to look at me with some, or I was projecting they were looking at me, which is much closer to the truth, that they were expecting something from all those years of practice that I wasn't manifesting or didn't feel capable of manifesting. In fact, some of the teachers at that point started to nudge me towards teaching, and I didn't feel capable of doing that. And so I knew that I couldn't hold the projection. That was the problem. I knew that I wasn't strong enough to take the seat of teaching or even hold some of the projections without teaching. And so I always knew intuitively somehow that the whole of the meditation was to get back to what was ordinary, and that assuming an image and the role and all of the projection that comes on to sitting, I just felt that wasn't how I wanted to manifest, what I wanted to do. So I took off and went to Houston, where I knew no one, and no one knew anything about me, which was wonderful. I never felt more free. People would call me on things and in non-dharmic ways, you know, like shut up, Rodney. And it was actually very helpful because that's what I wanted. I wanted my humanity to be rubbed up against. And I didn't even care about if people were kind necessarily. I really wanted the full range of the human experience and got it because I was in many ways very immature in who I was and needed that kind of contact so that I could come to some understanding in those areas. But actually, it's very interesting how I got involved in teaching. I was down there. No one knew anything about me, but I had sent a resume down to the hospice, and you have to fill in the 8 years that you weren't doing something. So I had put, you know, Buddhist monk, and so this woman was visiting the hospice program and was a friend of the director and was looking at my resume and saw that. And she also had a farm, and she was inviting people like Stephen Levine and Ram Dass to come through her farm and offer retreats. And she came up to me and she said, "Oh, I want you to do a insight meditation retreat," just like that. And I didn't think fast enough and said, "Well, I'll come out and see the farm." And one thing led to another, and that's how it started for me. It had nothing to do with anyone, you know, knowing something about me really or anything. And everywhere I've gone, I've given up teaching when I left. When I came to Seattle, I said, "Well, I have a job, hospice care. If I never teach, it's not that I don't like teaching. It's just that I don't need to teach. I didn't need to." And then when I got in town there in Seattle, Steve Armstrong, who was teaching at Cloud Mountain, people were wondering if there was anybody around the area that had any teaching experience, and Steve pointed to me, and that's how that whole thing got going. But it was never a desire for me to wrap myself in the role or in the image of the teacher. What has led the way for me, and I hope it leads the way for you, is not to form an image around this practice. That it's just the opposite. It's what is it when we stand naked of that image? When we aren't dependent upon any form or expression of people's need for us. Doesn't mean we don't have all the social anxiety that anyone else has, that we want to be liked and all of that sort of thing, but just not to embody the image as the reason we do something. Because it's fakey, it's false, it's inauthentic. And it's really the need to be other than ourselves. I don't think there's a word in the language that perhaps frightens us more than ordinariness. And this culture in particular has an imperative behind it to be other than ordinary, to be distinguished, to be above average, like Lake Wobegon, right? We want to all live at Lake Wobegon. And I can see it running through my nieces, who one of my nieces is extraordinarily bright, straight A student, valedictorian of her high school class, and now is in her second year of college at Whitman, a very good school, and she hasn't made a B. I don't know if she's ever made a B in her high school or college or elementary school life. And she is, you know, that is her sense of perfectionism, her sense of identity around being this extraordinary student is so strong that it may just really scar her when the inevitable comes and she isn't able to maintain that image, which it will. And my hope for her is that she gets a B in college, so that she can begin to understand that it's not about that. Life has to be lived from a different dimension than the dimension of perfectionism, because it's not maintainable. And the striving to do so is the very hurt we're trying to understand in this practice. The other niece I have is very non-academic, and she's just getting through and all of that, and her self-understanding is compared to her sister's. Now, she doesn't want to be ordinary. And so there's that growing self-dislike because she isn't as extraordinary as her sister. And, you know, you just get caught in the middle of all that as an uncle, and there's not too much you can say to your sister, who is promoting both of those subtly, those roles for each of them. You should be more like your sister, and good job, Kathleen, that you aren't getting anything but A's. So ordinariness, distinguish ourselves, keep our head clearly above the crowd, and that need, the flight from ordinariness, that flight from ordinariness, that when we sit, you see, we're not distinguished. When we close our eyes and we feel ourselves as reality, as the expression of reality, there's absolutely no configuration there whatsoever that we can not only call our own, but that we can say is better than someone else's. It all comes to manifestation when we open our eyes and look around, and then the comparing mind begins to see how well someone is sitting compared to me. And so it follows us very strongly into the meditation, and we have to look at this sense of wanting to be other than where the practice takes us, which is right into the ordinary. And as I was mentioning in the last talk, this sense of boredom is a cue for us that we are, that the sameness is somehow showing itself in boredom. It's just, the sameness. And unless we're progressing in our practice, unless we feel like there's some way that we're moving and movement of it, then sameness is not respected. It's not appreciated. Repetition is not appreciated. We have to feel ourselves moving out of sameness into something other than that. May I say, though, that there's extraordinary value in repetition in this practice. Very few of us get it the first time we see it. And after you see it and see it and see it and see it and see it for the infinite number of times, suddenly there can be a breakthrough insight or an understanding that has up until that point been held at bay, often because we think of this thing as being boring, or I've seen this before. We dismiss it. We whitewash until at some point the sun breaks through the clouds. The mind likes to point ahead. Boredom is a signal that what is happening to me now, this series of repetitious experiences, I know all this, you know, I've seen this all before, that I'll wait it out so that something else will come and show, and then I can be excited and I can be stimulated. Christine and I were speaking at dinner about the need for stimulation in this culture, that everyone has a cell phone and access to the internet, often on their belts or in their purses. But you know, it's interesting, when we're lonely or bored, the first thing we do is pick up our telephone or get on the internet. We don't allow ourselves to feel those feelings. Those feelings implicate us so strongly as being ordinary. And we want to be other than that. We want to be valued. We want to feel our sense of worth. So we'll call somebody. And I haven't seen the statistics on it yet, but I wager that as this generation of cell phone users matures, they're going to be immature in relationship to many of their emotional expressions because they haven't lived with them as generations prior to that have had to do, because we didn't have access to that kind of media that could take us away from it so easily. I go to the University of Washington gym several times a week just to work out on some of those things. And I'll get on one of these elliptical machines. And this is really the truth. And this is not infrequent. The student, the young college student next to me will be on the elliptical machine. There's a television going. She'll be strapped to her iPod, listening to her iPod, reading a textbook, watching the TV, and doing the elliptical machine. And seeming to enjoy all of those. But at an expense. There is an expense to that kind of fractured attention. Let's not fool ourselves and say that they're multitasking and aren't they an amazing generation that can do they're not. Attention is not like that. It's no better than our attention and no better than the generations prior to us. And something is missing there. Some contact, some resolution, some contentment. In fact, if all that isn't going on, what is their state of mind and how willing are they able to force and how willing are they able to be with that state of mind without forcing a different level of stimulation and excitement to make life worth living? It's not a small thing we do. You know, I believe that's the reason that movies now, some of these movies that are coming back around that nobody thought would be, anyone would attend, like Winged Migration, was just birds in flight. For 2 hours, you sit and watch birds fly. Or March of the Penguins, where you just see penguins walking. And I was enthralled. Couldn't have been a better plot. And you just sit there and watch them. You know? And you go, wow. And it's because there's something in us, some part of us, some resonance that longs deeply for that kind of nurturance, that kind of simplicity, that kind of ordinariness. And so we're going to the movies now. And in fact, fewer people are attending the blockbuster movies than last year and the year before. And there's a decrease in attendance to movies. But these other movies, which people thought would be sort of off-Broadway hits, you know, just kind of are really being well attended. There's another one we saw about a camel. It was in Mongolia. There wasn't an English word or subtitle in the whole thing. They spoke Mongolian the whole time about some camel, and it was a great movie. Did you see that one? What was it called?
The Weeping Camel.
That's what it is. The Weeping Camel. And there's something there. There's something, you know, where our heart longs to go. Our heart longs to go. But see, the cultural imperative, that's why we're up against insurmountable odds here. There's nothing that the culture would rather have us do than stay out of balance. To stay needy in ways that we don't even, that are unconscious to us. And so we have to be smarter than that. We have to look at this thing. You know, we're not doing this meditation for a greater acknowledgement, for a certificate, for a claim. What are we doing it for? What are we doing it for? Perhaps for no greater reason than to hear the sound of the waves or feel the touch of the wind. For that's the truly satisfying, true contentment. Somehow we sense that true contentment must be through those doors. Must be derived from that. But because the cultural imperative is to be above average, to be anything but ordinary, we try to find our way out of ordinariness, often by acting out, by being the clown, by carrying drama, being a drama queen or king. Or we're always having some terrible thing happening to us, you see. Or we can be one, you know, we can be in terms of adventure, or rock climbers or whatever, daring. Or we can be anti-establishment, we can be anti-something, we can lend our voice to a crisis. We could be an adversary. Lots of ways that we can stand out, isn't there? There is this. Sometimes people think I'm making this up, but I'm not making this up. On NPR, about a couple of months ago, they were interviewing a woman who was breaking the Guinness World Book records for staying in a small room, about a 6'5", 8-foot room, just long enough for her to lie down, have a chair there, I guess, or whatever, with 3,000 scorpions in the room. And she was staying there for 30 days with 3,000 scorpions, because I guess the previous record was 29 days. And they were interviewing her. This shows the absurdity of how far we'll go. They interviewed her, and she said she was so happy. She was like maybe a week from the end, and she'd only been stung 7 times. Isn't that wonderful? You've only been stung 7 times. Oh, Lordy. See, we confuse attention with self-worth, don't we? You know, please give me in your attention, I can validate myself. That's what our heart feels. Because to be ordinary is not to receive, be worth anyone's attention. And if I can stay in the room for 30 days with 3,000 scorpions, then maybe, for a moment at least, I can feel a sense of worth. That's what we really want. The validation of somebody's attention so that we can be worth that attention. Now you can see perhaps why and how we bring attention to ourselves is so important. Today we did metta, and we threw that metta back so that the neutral person was giving metta back to us. How worthy did we feel of receiving the neutral person's metta? It was easy, perhaps much easier, to give it to the neutral person, but how about in receiving it? How about allowing ourselves to feel validated or deserving of that? And this sense of needing other people for my sense of validation means that I can only feel worth through your eyes. I can't feel it through my own. When I close my eyes, I feel the static condition, the seemingly static condition of my worthlessness. This is what drives this need to be above average, so that I can catch somebody's glance. See, what an interesting paradox of the whole thing is, though I want to be seen as being special, even as I try to hide my imperfection of unworthiness. I want you to look, but I don't want you to look too closely at me. I want to be looked at, but not really seen for who I am. And so as a culture, we have developed a whole strategy not to be seen. And why is there such a premium on our appearance? Because that's where the gaze stops. If somebody is very beautiful or pretty or handsome, then it doesn't have to go any deeper into the sense of who I am. It can stop at the appearance level. And so we have this enormous industry to keep our attention, to gain somebody's attention, to be beautiful enough, but let it stop there because I don't want them to go any deeper. And if we aren't very pretty, which most of us aren't in comparison to the models that run around as some kind of ideal statements of beauty, then we develop our personalities. We just stop there. Stop, I'll be a really nice person. And maybe that will arrest your attention from going any further. So my personality is my second way that I can block the depth. And then when we get into a relationship or something where attention naturally seeks the lowest, its own level of intimacy, then how are we with that? How are we with being able to open and share that intimacy with one another? Because that's where we're really afraid. And we're most of us, many of us in this culture, perhaps not most, many of us in this culture are scared to death of somebody having access, that kind of access. Because that's what we're trying to protect ourselves from. That's where the ordinary is. And if I can't have a extraordinary appearance or a personality that stands out, then I don't have the protection I need to keep me from intimacy, so that I'll just dodge that bullet and never move in that direction. So the fear of intimacy. And at the same time that we're trying to raise ourselves up, so that people will notice it. Culturally, at the same time, we need to stay within a particular dimension of okayness called conformity. We want to stand apart from the crowd, but not too far apart from the crowd, right? Within acceptable limits. Or we'll be seen as weird, and weird isn't okay either. I had a friend who was dyslexic, and he spent his whole childhood reading things backward and always being, he's a very bright man, but always being in the lowest reading group. And but his character never suffered at all, because he'd go home and he would tell his mother how weird he was compared to all the other teachers or the other students. And his mother would say, "Oh, honey," she would say, "weirdness is wonderful." And he was raised in that kind of environment, and he believes it. To this day, he believes it and loves his uniqueness. He actually takes pride in reading things backward, which he can still do. He can read them frontward, but he can also see things backward and read the words backward. He is truly weird. So one force stretches us upward. Another force presses us downward. You see the vice we're caught in? We bind ourselves to the familiar even as we strive to gain advantage. And that's, of course, those are the ingredients that stymies creativity, uniqueness, spontaneity, joy. We hold ourselves back because we don't want to risk spontaneity, because we'll be seen as being too strange if we're spontaneous. So we don't want to be average, but we don't want to be creative. And yet the Dharma is to break through those patterns. How are we going to do that? How are we going to possibly break through that kind of social stigma? Unless we simply do not care what people may think. Some of you might have read that Dennis Kucinich article that was in Tricycle Magazine. Dennis was one of the presidential candidates during this last race. And he is a Buddhist, and he was being interviewed by Tricycle. And the interviewer said, "You know, Dennis, you're seen as kind of a spiritual flake by most Americans." And Dennis said, "Well, you know, what other people think of me is none of my business." Now just let that in for a second. What other people think of me is none of my business. If we really lived according to that, he's absolutely right. It is none of our business. We have no control on it, one. We don't have control of our own mind, let alone what people are projecting onto us. And for us to work as if we did, and to start changing and checking and molding ourselves according to how we think they must believe about us, given this behavior that I'm now, is just completely, completely the wrong way to take ourselves in. You see, in order for us to come back, we have to understand why we're being driven from being ordinary, from the willingness to settle into our ordinariness, because there is so much pain associated with just being me, and how most of us hold ourselves. We're afraid that if we are seen as ordinary, what person will really see is what I'm afraid of knowing in myself, that I'm not worth knowing. That if you look deeply enough in me and see me as the ordinary person that I feel inside, that somehow your perception will then be that I'm simply not worth knowing. Someone will see me as ineffective as I believe I am. We are driven to be more than we want to be, more than we think we are, because we are afraid of being who we are. And so we constantly strive for some image of ourselves that can stretch itself up for a moment. And in that stretching up, and in the judgment of putting everybody else down, which is an attempt to stretch up, that's why we judge. We judge in order to raise ourselves up in the moment for up above the fray, and in the judgment let everybody else sink down. And in that moment there's a respite from our own self-pain and that artificial elevation of our judgment. So it's the fleeing of the pain inside of ourselves. And if you look at much of the strategies of our life, it's in flight of the pain of our self-beliefs. And we can go a long time in meditation holding on to the self-beliefs, having our meditation derived from those beliefs, never questioning them, just holding them as an assumption, a basic assumption. Or we can look, because in the moment of our judgment, in the moment of our longing to be extraordinary, the pain of our image is there. It is not somewhere else. It's right there in the moment of judgment. We need not extrapolate. We need not analyze to find it. We are being driven by it, and therefore it is present if we're willing to look. We just don't often have the know how to look in the right direction to be able to hold the pain, to be able to look at it. We so believe it to be essentially me. We think that inside of us are the demons. You know, there's the beautiful image that comes to mind was when the Buddha, when Mara was attacking the Buddha. Mara is our mind, but there's a manifestation personified by something outside of us doing something to us. And Mara was tempting the Buddha with all kinds of self-doubt and, you know, self-questioning and with arrows, it shows. But each arrow, as it was in mid-flight, would be changed to lotus blossoms because the Buddha was not willing to hide from the pain. He wasn't willing to, he was willing to acknowledge everything. And for those arrows to stick, he would have had to turn from his pain, acclaim the image from which the pain was derived, and then the arrow would have stuck. As the arrows of our own mind stick to us, when we make that self-assumption again and again, that we are not worth knowing or being seen. The pain follows us. We can't get rid of it. It's not something that's going to go away through praise, through being validated, through other people's eyes. That's why when all of the show is over, we often feel as miserable as we ever did, regardless of how in the spotlight we were for a few moments, or how many positive evaluations we got, or what kind of grades we got. Those are often attempts to put distance between ourselves and the pain. We need to see that. That small sense of me that is so afraid to look at what it believes about itself. What image are we holding in this moment? What is behind the fear of being seen? What is that image in this moment? What pain of inadequacy is playing itself out? Let me see that. enough of this. Enough of this madness. There is an article, maybe some of you saw it in the Seattle Times, about a 11-year-old boy who had an illness called progeria. And progeria is an illness in which every year of your chronological life, you actually have 10 years of physiological life, so that you're aging 10 times faster than somebody the same age. So this little old man was 80 years old or plus 80 years old, and he had arthritis, and he was walking with a cane, and he was bald-headed. He was about 3 feet high, and all his friends, his school friends, were towering over him. It showed him in the middle of his, in the corridors of his school. And there was an 11-year-old kid, you know, and he talks like an old man, and there's nothing in the world that kid would rather be than ordinary. Nothing. How fortunate we are. How fortunate we are. You know, I learned the lesson of that when I was in the forest of Thailand. And Ajahn Buddhadasa, again and again, would tell me, he would say, let the forest teach you. Forest is your teacher. So I would go out to the cabin, and literally for the first 6 months of the year I was there, I had no idea what he was talking about. I was too busy doing my sitting and walking to let anything in. And then one day I was sitting on the porch, and I just felt completely content. And I knew that there was nothing to do, and that I was really, truly letting in nature. And I had, somehow it snuck in there some way. And I understood what he meant by being authentic, letting the forest touch our authenticity, our ordinariness. Our ordinariness. Because fear of being ordinary is in direct opposition to our authenticity. And authenticity means that we live without adding anything, without protection, without defense. What is, that's it. I know, it's something that, it's a lesson that somehow has, even before I was formally introduced to the Dharma, during my years of being a hippie in the 60s, I never could settle with being in those costumes, I agreed with the philosophy of the time, but it just felt like people were giving up one suit for another one. And so I didn't want any part of that kind of pretension, really, for me, to be rather than to seem. To be rather than to seem. We think ourselves out of an authentic life because we're so afraid that to be authentic means the authentic me of my pain. It doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean that. We have to look at that pain. In Dharma, we go through our psychological. We transcend the psychological. That doesn't mean we shunt or go around it. The psychological opens up to the transcendence when we are afraid of what the meaning of that psychological mood or disposition is. It's the fear that keeps the thing solid. Once we acknowledge it, open to it, and see it for what it is, we can move right through it. It's no problem whatsoever. It's just that we have invested it with so much fixed response. This is me, we say. And it's the fear that is the problem, not the thing itself. I can feel pain. What difference does it make? You can feel pain. You feel pain all the time. Why not? You see, when we open it up with that kind of courage, heart, then it can't stick. We see it for what it is, which is nothing. Smokescreen. We don't get out of anything in Dharma. We don't get away from with any of ourselves. Someone once said that their neurosis doesn't seem to interrupt their spiritual growth. Well, I would say that person needs to look again. Their neurosis is definitely tripping them up. They just aren't recognizing it. Because wherever we're fixated, neurotically, believing that this is me, we're held fast in the quicksand of that assumption. Soon to choke. And we begin to understand that the Dharma is the ordinary made manifest. That the sacred comes through the ordinary, not in opposition to the ordinary. Things as they are. What is that but the ordinary? So there will be no contentment until we're content with the ordinary. Until we can relax with nature, spiritual paths lead against our nature. This is it. This is the call of the wild. This is the wind and the sun. This is the emotion. This is the assumption. Contentment must come through this way. And we learn that we are not going to find and never will find that contentment based in the mind. That the mind is full of argument. It's full of contention and will because it exists through that contention. And its existence is at stake, so it continues to contend with things. And yet slowly we sense something as we become more and more accustomed to holding life just as it is. We sense a stillness. We sense a permeation of quietude that the mind cannot capture and that the senses cannot catch, but it's there unmistakably. Unmistakably. Because it is the true resonant of the heart of simplicity. It is the true resonant of the heart from ordinariness. Life as it is, life as it's being lived. Jim Harrison, an author, said, "We Americans are taught to think big, talk big, act big, love big, admire bigness. But then the essential mystery is in the small." Are we big enough to find the sacred in the small? Do we have the courage enough? That is the question of the Dharma. Can we sit for a minute or two?